You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 24. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. Let me tell you a story. My research recently involved working with some propaganda materials produced by the Nazis in the 1940s. That was really emotionally hard to work through. I mean, shivers down my spine, very uncomfortable. Now, imagine you have the same experience every time you walk into a museum or see a particular kind of exhibition. For some people, that's an everyday reality. Reckoning with those experiences is the theme of today's episode from the STS Newsroom. In this episode, reporter Alex Hancock investigates an exhibition at UCL's Grant Museum of Zoology. And he does this to show that this small and seemingly innocuous museum of natural history really displays stories of power and appropriation and empire. The overall idea is to investigate what's being represented in our museums. It's not just things, but it's important ideas that shape our present. Alex then turns to the wider subject of inclusion and engagement in museums. He discusses recent research on audiences by Professor Emily Dawson. Museums might say they cater to everyone, but when some communities visit, the overall reaction is that those places are either hostile or irrelevant to their lives. Emily is an important advocate for change and representation in this area, and Alex takes a good long time to hear what she has to say. This episode was recorded in 2021, not only when the pandemic was causing closures, but also when the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter campaign were high on the political agenda. Alex picks things up from the start. I'll just sit back and let him take over. I'll see you on the other side.
The reopening of museums across England raises a host of different questions, like can museums recover from the impact of COVID, and are people ready to go back to indoor public spaces? But perhaps the most important questions here aren't to do with attendance numbers or ticket sales, but about the exhibitions these museums display. After a year that's seen seismic political and social changes, with events like the Black Lives Matter protests which followed after the murder of George Floyd last May, and the toppling of famous statues, the state of museums looks more precarious now than ever. As conversations about boycotting museums and returning stolen artifacts continue to enter the public consciousness, important questions do too. How will museum displays change in the future? Will these institutions acknowledge the relationship between ownership and colonialism? And how will UCL, an institution rooted in these very issues, adapt to these changes? I'm your host, Alexander Hancock, and you're listening to the We Are STS podcast. To try and answer these questions, we start right here, at one of UCL's four museums, and perhaps its most controversial. I talked to Tanis Davidson, the curator of the Grant Museum of Zoology, about some of the work she's done with its exhibition, Displays of Power, an introspective and revelatory collection that explores how the British Empire exercised its far-reaching control through collecting zoological specimens from some of the rarest species around the world. Then, we take a look at some of the social and political events that have taken place over the past year and what they might mean for the future of museums. Before we get going, I'd just like to say a big thank you to Tanis for joining the podcast today. We really appreciate it. I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about yourself and the kind of work you do.
So I am the curator of the Grant Museum of Zoology. So my job is really to care for the use of the collection, which is about 68,000 specimens. So it's always been a teaching museum. So we do a lot of teaching with the collection, certainly UCL students, but students from other HE institutions internationally and around London and the UK. So anything to do with the collection, really. So not only teaching, but research, loans, exhibitions, that kind of thing.
Speaking about the Grant Museum of Zoology and the Displays of Power exhibition, which explores the relationship between the British Empire and the collection, the museum acknowledges its colonial past, but it also makes an effort to spotlight the issue and to raise awareness about its shameful history. What was the impetus behind organizing the exhibition? And did you have any reservations about highlighting these issues?
Well, the impetus for doing the temporary exhibition was working with a colleague at my time, Subhadra Das, who has now left UCL, but she was the former curator of the science collection. Up to this point, you know, a lot of early conversations had been started about art museums and archaeology museums, but not so much natural history collections and how that fits in with the discussion of decolonizing museums. So we wanted to explore that with the Grant Museum, being a small natural history museum. So one of the challenges of the exhibition is, of course, we are a historic collection. So most of the specimens are about 200 years old. So we don't have a lot of full documentation or archival information to tell us where things came from, how they came into the collection, who brought them in, and that sort of thing. So that was initially the first kind of challenge about, you know, how do you tell these stories about the museum through specimens if you don't know everything about them? You know, if you look at the species that we have in the museum, you can kind of, you know, map them out according to the British Empire. So even though, you know, I don't know who shot the hippopotamus and which colonial collector or, you know, former colonists donated it to the museum, I could say that, you know, this came from a place where the British were active in colonial Africa. Originally, it was kind of, you know, the idea was to sort of spotlight different specimens in the collection, you know, that told certain stories along with the themes that we chose for the exhibition. So we decided on kind of an intervention approach. So labels were put on the cases. Not much was moved around in the museum. We don't have a temporary exhibition space as it is, but we thought that, you know, just sort of shining a light on, you know, anything, you know, we kind of took the idea that we, you know, we took take the viewer on a journey. So, you know, kind of the early days of the beginning of the collection, which, you know, started in 1828. So, you know, this kind of fits into like kind of the early British Empire, and then the next stage is kind of the consolidation of the empire and, you know, how that's reflected in the collection. So you can see different sorts of things coming in, you know, as different kind of science, you know, was being justified, and people were bringing things back from the colonies, and a lot of large national museums, certainly the Natural History Museum, was built during this time of the consolidation of empire, and really, you know, meant as a temple to kind of, you know, not only of nature, but to justify the exotic goods of empire. So, you know, put all of the goodies on display, the people will come, everyone's okay with it, that kind of a thing.
The exhibition obviously reflects the colonial past of the museum, but it also reflects the colonial past of UCL. One plaque in the collection explores the origins of the university and reveals that some of the founders of UCL were actually slave owners. On top of being engaging and informative, do you think museums carry the responsibility of educating the public about their past?
I mean, I think it's best practice, and we should all be doing it and not be intimidated. And then one of the reasons why I think that we kind of got away with it is because we are a small museum. We're not, you know, a large national, and perhaps there would have been, you know, if there'd been a different kind of publicity on it, there may have been backlash. But, you know, the good thing about UCL is that, you know, we're supposed to be this organization that, you know, challenges the norm. And, you know, it's good to see, even, you know, with the new provost speaking all the right words recently on, you know, that we're here to have challenging conversations. So to have the support of the university to kind of try these sort of things has been, you know, great. I think that, you know, we have a responsibility, you know, not only as a museum, but as part of the university to make our voices heard and to add to the conversation. As you know, UCL has got this troubling history with eugenics and all of the work that's been going on with the changing building names and all of that. So, you know, that ball was already rolling as well.
Do you think we'll continue to see museums, specifically in London, try and hide the more sinister elements of their past? Or do you think with everything that's happened in the past year, museums will make a conscious effort to acknowledge their colonial histories and the oftentimes unethical methods that are used to obtain the collections that they display?
Well, a few months ago, I would have said, yeah, I think that, you know, the ball's rolling. It's kind of, you know, the zeitgeist and everyone's like on board with it. And generally, natural history museums have this kind of, you know, we're not like the British Museum or, you know, the Royal Academy of Art. So we're kind of, you know, a little bit more edgy with the things that we do in general anyways. And like the people that, you know, in that, like all of the, you know, the curators and people involved in natural history generally do that to a certain degree in the same way that, you know, British Museum cannot. However, you know, with this now, this new like cancel culture and, you know, what the government is doing and all of that, I'm not sure. I think maybe on one hand, there will be kind of a stronger push to, you know, make those voices even louder than they perhaps would have been organically. But on the other hand, you know, large museums that receive a lot of government funding might be slightly hesitant to do so. So it's kind of an interesting time to see what is going to happen. And I think, you know, again, with universities, you know, various universities that have museums, you know, have some have a lot of support from the university, some not so much, or, you know, they're fighting kind of political media battles at the moment. So I don't know, watch this space really. So, you know, I'd like to think, you know, with everything that sort of changed in the world over the last year, like certainly with Black Lives Matter and all of that, you know, there's kind of this impetus from like the public and, you know, people that want to kind of, you know, like, let's be open about things. Like, let's have this conversation. Like, you know, you don't have to like it, but here's one interpretation, right? You know, you're free to give your interpretation if you don't like it. So, you know, I hopefully there'll be more of that, really.
We're going to take a quick break, but after that, we'll take a look at the history behind the Grant Museum of Zoology, and then I talk to Dr. Emily Dawson about her work with museums and how these institutions might change in the next couple of years. We'll be right back.
Are you thinking about UCL for your master's degree? The Department of Science and Technology Studies offers three MSc degrees, one in Science, Technology and Society, another in History and Philosophy of Science. And we have a new MSc in Science Communication available starting 2022. These programs are designed for specialist training, preparation for PhD programs, and practical career development. To find out more, visit us online at ucl.ac.uk/STS.
Let's get back to Alex's episode. He's going to transition now from talking about a historical collection to talking about current research into museum inclusion and engagement. Let's see where he takes us now.
As soon as you walk through the doors of the Grant Museum of Zoology, you can immediately feel the legacy of empire. Over 150 years old, the museum is lined with display cabinets containing specimens from all over the world. Elephant skulls from India, impala trophy heads from Kenya, bird eggs from Madagascar. The museum, while small, paints a detailed portrait of the British Empire and its rule in North America, Africa, Asia, and Australasia. As you tour the building, you learn just how expansive the rule of the empire was, and how many of the specimens on display in the museum were donated by colonial officers, many of whom worked in trade routes amongst these colonies. What's equally striking, as Tanis just explained, is the museum and UCL's acknowledgement of their involvement in the trade of dead and living animals. For example, one panel reveals that, in association with the British Empire, Robert Grant, the professor of comparative anatomy who worked at UCL during the 19th century, brought back platypus specimens to examine whether the animals laid eggs. Not only that, descriptions of UCL's founders and their involvement in slave ownership are front and center here. One plaque displays a stark message to those visiting the museum. It reads, quote, "Britain was built on slavery, and the Grant Museum is no exception to this," end quote. It's statements like these that highlight the museum's dedication to illuminating its shameful past. But what about other museums in the UK? Are these bigger institutions making a conscious effort to shine a light on the history behind the millions of items on display? And have recent events made an impact on their willingness to come forward about their involvement in immoral practices? To try and understand these questions in a broader context, I speak with Dr. Emily Dawson, an associate professor in the STS department here at UCL, about her work with British museums, the structural inequalities built into these institutions, and whether any real change amongst these museums in the future is feasible. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today, Dr. Dawson. We really appreciate it. I was wondering if you could talk about some of your research, specifically your work with museums here in the UK.
Most of the work I've done, I began by working in museums. So I worked in exhibitions and I worked in evaluation. And I began to see some problems around entrenched patterns of privilege, I suppose you could call it, in both who the staff were and in who the visitors were, and in the kinds of exhibitions that we would put on and the programming that we would do. And I couldn't get much traction around that inside museums at the time. So I went into some research jobs where I was able then to look specifically at how social inclusion and social exclusion and social justice could be understood in places like museums. And the work I did there, I stopped working directly with visitors and with staff, which is the normal way that people do most museum research. And I worked instead with people who never went to museums. And I worked with community groups in the borough that I lived in central London, who were sort of approached on the basis that through conversations with community gatekeepers, they felt that their community really didn't know much about museums, really didn't ever go to them, and didn't feel particularly that they were places that they would expect to go. So I worked with different community groups in Southwark and Lambeth for about 3 years, exploring their views then of science as it became public, institutions like museums. And we did a number of what I call in them, you know, methods terms, accompanied visits, where we all went to a museum together and they chose where they wanted to go. And it was all paid for within the project. And then that really, those visits informed really quite a damning critique of museum practice.
As you said, some of your research has explored how museums are inherently exclusive to certain underrepresented groups within society, and that for a lot of people, museums just aren't welcoming places. This is a big question and one that we could probably spend a whole podcast talking about, but why do you think certain groups feel unwelcome at these institutions?
Well, I mean, there's 1,000 answers to that, aren't there? So I suppose perhaps one thing to reflect on that we've looked at in some of our projects is we're not even necessarily talking about what we might call minoritized or minority groups. So there's huge gender problems in museums, and women are, isn't it 51% of the population, which would make us arguably a numerical majority, even if we are still minoritized by structural inequalities. So it's really useful to think about how structural inequalities map out in museum spaces, and thinking through that in terms of frameworks like intersectionality. So what we really see is that museums, as with so many other places, they're really dominated by richer white men. And the stories that are told are the stories of richer white men, often dead. And the practices that are most valued are those of richer white men. And then where that patterns down for the kinds of visitors is you'll see the more enfranchised, typically upper middle class families, from the dominant ethnic majority in this country, which is a white background, in urban settings, frequently attending these kinds of places. But these are also the people who get all the other resources. So in that sense, it really kind of creates a position where the already well-resourced can generate more resource. And those who are perhaps less resourced have kind of meet the sharp ends of structural inequalities more frequently. And then they find these kinds of spaces quite inaccessible. So across different projects we've worked with, so it's the community groups project that I discussed a minute ago, but there's also been schools projects, and we've worked often with schools who don't do that well in urban centres. And some of our schools have then been shut down as failing schools. So we work with teachers and families and students in specific groups. And in one project, we worked with young people from when they were 11 all the way through to when they left that school, and their families and their teachers, to try and kind of create a flow between museums, the families, and the school science classroom. And even there, it's just incredibly difficult, because the way the museums are structured is really elitist. So they're off-putting in so many ways, and they are then repeating structural inequalities. So they kind of both echo those structural inequalities and recreate them. Would you like an example from one of the accompanied visits we've done?
If you don't mind, that would be great.
So what we looked at in one of our projects, one of the kind of big multi-site projects, was young people from inner London schools going on a visit to a science museum. And what we saw there in the multiple accompanied visits, and these were the young people we were with for 5 years, so we knew them pretty well. And we did a lot of kind of before and afterwards interviewing and focus groups, and we spoke to their parents and their teachers, and we went on these visits with them. And the ones that volunteered to be recorded, wore kind of recording devices. And what we saw, so those were young people from central London. They were really mixed in terms of race, ethnicity. So there were British African kids, but there were also Afro-Caribbean British kids. There were Polish British kids. There were Turkish kids. There were kids who were white British working class. They were really mixed. And they, as a group, no one felt comfortable in the museum. And it was really sort of quite stark. And what we realized when we went through with them was that they only encountered one image of any person of color, which was a small toddler from an unnamed African country with smallpox scars all over their face in one of the medical galleries that really shocked and appalled all of the kids, I should say. They were all completely horrified. But we realized afterwards that was the only person of color they encountered in any of the content in the whole museum. They also only encountered any women in the context of childbirth. And these were quite sort of painful encounters. So one was a woman surrounded by surgeons in a diorama in the middle of giving birth. And the others were birthing stools and chastity belts and sort of various implements that had been used to hack up and saw up women to get babies out. So the sort of the context in which they saw any representation of women or people of colour was absolutely horrifying and surrounded by a kind of white male saviourism. And all the people that were lauded and valued and kind of highlighted as heroes were these kind of great white rich men of science. And that imagery was repeated kind of endlessly. So if you think about these kids then, what are they supposed to identify with there? How are they supposed to see themselves in relation to this space and the content that this space is kind of showing them?
Earlier, I spoke with Tanis Davidson, who works as a curator of the Grant Museum of Zoology, and we talked about the museum's effort to decolonize its collection. It had me thinking about a lot of your research and how you've explored how museums are in a way tailored to a target group, to a certain type of visitor. For people who traditionally feel unwelcome at museums, do you think they'd be more likely to visit these spaces if the museums were more honest about their colonial histories?
I think I'm going to do an annoying yes and no answer. I think it's really important to be transparent about where these institutions come from. And in British history, the output of the elites, they are, you know, set up by extremely wealthy people who have, in many cases, gone abroad, looted and plundered and bought things back here, had a private collection, and then at some point, either they or a family member who has survived them have made those collections permanent. In continental Europe, often the exhibitions were royal. So if you look at the Viennese Museum of Natural History, that is the royal collection. And here, the royal link's not quite so clear. Our royals weren't collecting quite so much. Although, of course, we have the Victoria and Albert Museum, which has got a clear royal heritage. And all of those practices of collecting are themselves hugely problematic, but based, of course, on wealth, which comes from the transatlantic slave trade, as well as various other many forms of colonialism and empire, which, you know, they were celebrating. So what's interesting is if you look at the so-called culture wars and the current culture minister, he's sort of got this, you know, no statue should come down. You have to just leave the statues up and explain some of the history. But actually, I think you get into a really difficult conversation there, because that's a profoundly conservative view, isn't it? He wants to retain the statues, very easy to change the interpretation later on. And I think the same could be saying of sort of decolonialism work. You can change a label very easily, but the big statue or the big exhibition is still there. So I think it is important to do that work. I think it's important who you do that work with and who leads that work. I think it's important about how you talk about that work, and that work is probably never finished. I think it's also important to talk about repatriation, and for whatever, I mean, we understand the reasons behind power and maintaining that, but the conversations about repatriation always absolutely startle me, because it makes absolutely no sense to me as to why we would not immediately repatriate everything.
Over the past year, we've seen a lot of statues across the world toppled, and now we're seeing a lot of people boycott museums and making petitions to have items removed. Do you think this global awareness of the history of statues and exhibitions was in a way catalyzed by the Black Lives Matter protests last May? Or has this awareness been simmering for a while?
The first time students of mine got really interested in it was in around 2015-16 with the Roads Must Fall campaigns in the UK. One of the modules I teach in the master's course about science, technology, and identity, the students do half of the class, and that was one of the things they were really passionate about. So they did a lot of work around those kinds of movements in that module, and that was the first time I'd noticed students bringing it up to me as an issue, and it started to make more coverage in different forms of media than it had previously. I think in museums and heritage spaces, those conversations have been had for a long time, and they're very difficult. And I know some of the bigger museums will have, you know, repatriation teams, and some of them don't consider it at all. And so we get into this really thorny space of how that has been handled. And I suppose what's interesting with the Black Lives Matter movement really becoming a kind of more of a global movement in the last year is that there's enough of a public conversation going on that there's possibilities around, I think, policy change. So where before 2015, 2016, it was, I think, a kind of a professional conversation, and then specific communities would be very much involved in activism about regaining objects from their cultural heritage. And that conversation was seen as a kind of museum sector conversation. And policies were at an institutional level, and it didn't really become a question of government policy. I think increasingly, with the visibility of that activism, institutions have had to, where they haven't had policies, create them, they've had to start to take it more seriously. And I suppose what I would really like to see is much more joined up thinking than arguably government policy. But I don't expect a conservative government to start to take that particularly seriously.
I think there's an interesting dichotomy that museums face in trying to strike a balance between maintaining the institution's tradition and being progressive and being modern. In your opinion, can there ever be a compromise between these two things, or by focusing on one, do you run the risk of losing the other?
Explain to me a bit more what you mean.
Well, I guess what I meant was, do you think the only solution to modernizing these museums and to making them more progressive is by collecting and rounding up all of the stolen items in these museums and returning them to the rightful owner, to the countries from which they originate? Or are there alternative solutions that maybe don't involve returning these items, but involve, you know, creating plaques and panels that explain the history of these items and explain the ways in which they were obtained?
I actually genuinely don't think it's that complicated. So if you think about natural history museums, almost all of the ones I've ever visited have got a mixture of, you know, quote unquote, real dead objects or minerals or fossil record objects. And then they have lots of replicas because, you know, a blue whale's quite hard to come by. So a lot of places will have a replica of a blue whale or replicas of dinosaurs or, you know, really amazing animatronics of how a particular velociraptor might have looked. There's a lot of other ways we can do really amazing exhibitions, really informative programming that doesn't in any way hinge on, well, I need to have this particular fossil or these human remains or this particular vase from Ethiopia or Eritrea. And so I think it's genuinely nonsensical that those objects have to stay here. Brian Iyonkoi has got a really fascinating book on how these debates have gone in North America and Canada with First Nations peoples around which museums keep whose exhibits, who gets to keep what, how those objects are understood from the perspective of the people whose cultural heritage that is. And often, for instance, some of the objects that the museum have are understood actually by the First Nations people that they've come from as alive, and that they are dying in this museum, and that's a hugely problematic thing. And then the museums, in her research, she documents how some of the museums, they're very reluctant to give the objects back, and they use reasons like, well, you can't look after the object properly, you can't keep it in the right kinds of preserved conditions. And actually, that's all value judgment, because the people from whom that object has been stolen have a very different view of what constitutes properly looking after it and maybe keeping that particular object, for instance, alive, or how those human remains ought to be treated in a respectful, culturally appropriate way. So the problem is power and quite how you can justify the need to retain cultural heritage and artifacts and bodies and even animals and their DNA from other nations and spaces and countries and peoples, especially when they want them back. I mean, I realize I'm sort of laughing because I feel like I'm saying an extreme thing. And actually, I really don't think I am. I cannot understand how you could substantiate a rational, justified argument for continuing to keep those objects away from the people that they were originally taken from.
Finally, in your view, what might museums look like, say, in 10 years? Do you think the conversations we're having now about decolonizing museums will actually have an effect on the kinds of displays we see in the future? Or does the thought of any real change seem overly optimistic?
Well, perhaps I'll answer that in two ways. I'll answer it with my wish list, and then I'll answer it with a slightly more realistic view. I think my wish list would be, I'd like to see all of that work that questions power and history and the complex histories of different contexts, different objects, different countries, different spaces, different people. And I'd really like to see a lot of the kind of entrenched and quite authoritarian sometimes ways that we present knowledge and content. I'd like to see that all shift. I'd like to see a huge shift in staffing. The number of people from communities of color and working class backgrounds working in museums is really tiny. And every new report that comes out just confirms it's a very small percentage of the working population, and likely to be even smaller in the pandemic. what we saw and what we were busy working on last summer with practitioner colleagues was in the 2008-09 recession, a lot of the jobs around community work, inclusion officers, those kinds of roles disappeared in wave after wave after wave of redundancy. And often the jobs that were less secure, which is where we had seen people from working class and communities of color backgrounds come into museums, they also disappeared. They were contracts that weren't renewed or they were vulnerable in some way. And what we saw then was a sort of consolidation of the kinds of people who might work in museums, kind of rich backgrounds or who could take the hit, because museum work's not paid terribly well. So you have to take a bit of a hit there or do a lot of this kind of background of volunteering and free internships. That's very dangerous for thinking about how you might broaden who works in those spaces. I'd also like to see the people in power in those spaces really radically change as well. I think that would be really useful. And I think trustee boards are another place where we can push for change and see that change echo down. So there's a kind of internal staffing change I'd really like to see. I'd really like to see a change in who those resources then are for and how people work with communities, alongside communities, thinking about what those communities might need in terms of support and how to support them, rather than always having the museum as maybe the central goal there. I'd really like to see a huge amount of content and collection changing and interpretation changing. I think there is possibility for that as well. So where I get to with those kinds of arguments is twofold. I think we do have to push for change within the sector. I think that's something we have to do. And I think that because despite the kind of Audre Lorde style argument of the master's tools cannot dismantle the master's house, the fact remains that those institutions exist. They don't think so, but they are well-funded. They will continue to be well-funded. They will continue to exist, especially some of the bigger, more stable ones. So we're not about to see them disappear overnight, which means we have to think radically about how to transform those institutions and the resources and opportunities they represent to make them open for all and not just for this very small group.
So it's clear change won't happen overnight. But as Tanis and Dr. Dawson explained, the reform of museums that so many have advocated for might be on the horizon. As movements like Black Lives Matter and other repatriation campaigns continue to gain global traction, we've seen major changes in the ways in which museums operate. Highly publicized controversies, including the debate surrounding the British Museum and their refusal to return the Benin bronzes to Nigeria, have led to important discussions regarding ownership and the long-lasting legacy of empire. Even in popular culture, movies like Black Panther have explored colonial-era theft and other forms of cultural appropriation, sparking online conversation amongst people of all ages. While gradual, it seems that museums are starting to respond to public demands for repatriation. Proof of this was on display when the German cultural minister promised to return colonial-era artifacts to Nigeria after the country came under fire for its possession of Benin bronzes, as did the Dutch government, who in 2020 returned manuscripts and royal artifacts to Indonesia, a former Dutch colony. With more museums engaging in the restitution of stolen relics and artifacts, it appears that the domino effect is in full swing. The future of museums post-COVID looks uncertain, but with the efforts of museums like the Grant Museum of Zoology and its decision to profile its colonial history, we can expect big changes in the ways in which they collect, display, and organize their exhibitions. Whether change will come about in the next couple of years is unclear, but what is clear is that museums can no longer keep their histories in the dark. And that's it for today's episode of the We Are STS podcast. I'd like to say a big thank you to Tanis and Dr. Dawson for joining me today. If you're interested in any of their work or the work they mentioned, make sure to check out the description box for more information. Special thanks goes to Young Logos and Bad Snacks for their songs Papov and Wallflowers. You can check out their music on YouTube's audio library. Before we go, I'd like to say thank you to you for joining us today. We'll see you next week for another episode, but until then, it's bye for now.
Thanks, Alex. Great work. Thanks also to Tanis Davidson and Professor Emily Dawson for their contributions. I think it's important to notice that the issues Alex raises here are very much still at the top of the agenda in museum studies and the public engagement of science. Here in SDS, we offer 3 master's degrees in which you can investigate issues such as those raised here, and you can develop skills to enact positive change. Some STS graduates certainly have pursued careers in museums and in communication so they can effect change in precisely the same directions. You can do it too. Music today included 2 pieces, Roland at 5 and Écossaise in E flat, both by Kevin MacLeod. Kevin, you're brilliant. Thanks for making these available. Both pieces are online at the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about our programs, listen to past episodes of the podcast, or just give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks to you for coming along. We'll have another episode coming soon. So until next time, everybody, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.